Hello and welcome to the Weekly Defence Podcast, the show about defence procurement and military technology, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Viasat. I'm your host, Ben Vogel, and on the show this week, we talk about current and upcoming technological trends in the world of simulation and training. And we also talk to the head of the US Army Futures Command about the country's six modernization priorities. But first, let's take a look at some of the week's headlines. In Russia, the military-industrial company has shed more light on the Strela light air transportable armoured car. A base model, amphibious variant and buggy variant for the Russian Airborne Forces will be officially exhibited next week at the Army 2020 show near Moscow. Afterwards, all vehicles will undergo state trials. Strela is currently unarmed, but in future it could be equipped with remote-controlled weapon stations. Today, the Russian ground forces lack light-protected vehicles weighing less than 5 tons, so adapting Strela could close this significant gap. Moving to South America now, and despite its crippling economic crisis, Venezuela appears keen to buy at least one airborne early warning and control aircraft, which would be a brand new capability for the country. Considering Venezuela's close ties with Russia and China, potential platforms include the Russian Beriev A-50E and the Chinese Avixian KJ-2000. However, both these aircraft are expensive to acquire and operate. They require lengthy and reinforced runways and, as far as it's known, the KJ-2000 is not available to foreign operators. And in Greece, the Navy recently commissioned its penultimate Rusen-class fast attack craft. And the final one is expected to follow in 2021, more than 20 years after the program began. Completion of the Rusen class will boost the Hellenic Navy at a time of rising tensions with Turkey over drilling rights in the eastern Mediterranean. A naval escort is accompanying the Turkish research ship Oruç Reis as it prospects between Cyprus and Crete, while Greece has deployed its own naval vessels to the area and is at high alert. Amid this situation, there was a collision between one Greek and one Turkish vessel on the 12th of August. And finally, it looks like the UK will explore specific naval applications for directed energy weapons in an initiative called Project Tracy. An invitation to tender was issued in early August to prospective bidders, and a competition is underway to identify a supplier. Project Tracy will conduct up to 12 months of directed energy weapon demos aboard a Royal Navy vessel. It's time for some news in focus now, and I'm joined by Air Editor Tim Martin and Land Reporter Flavia Camargos Pereira. Hello both.
Hi Ben.
Hello.
So starting with you, Tim, I'd like to talk about a story you've been chasing up about the Israeli Air Force's decision to ground its Black Hawk fleet. Sounds pretty serious. What's happened?
Yeah, so the service has decided to ground the fleet, as you mentioned, following a number of T-700 engine technical malfunctions. And so that's going to cover all non-operational flights and aircraft. So they're suspended effective immediately and pending an investigation to look into the engine issues.
So in broader terms, what's the problem?
Yeah, that's a difficult one to put our finger on because the IAF haven't been specific about this, and they're not offering any additional comment to the original announcement that was posted on its Twitter account on Monday. But General Electric did confirm that it is fully engaged and assisting with the investigation. And we know from last month when a story broke of an IAF Black Hawk involved in a near crash after a mid-air technical fault had forced the aircraft to unexpectedly fall to as low as 100 feet to the ground. And that was before our crew were able to recover from the issue and avert a potentially tragic incident. So yeah, there is, I suppose, some prior information that we can kind of glean to suggest that the aircraft itself has experienced some difficulties recently. And as the announcement said itself, the grounding is based on the fact that there's this discovery of these technical malfunctions covers issues over the last 2 months. So it's not just something that has suddenly emerged and the IAF are kind of making the decision, you know, just overnight.
As an aside, the incident you mentioned, it actually involved the Lieutenant General Aviv Kahavi, the IDF Chief of General Staff, who was a passenger on board the Black Hawk when it did unexpectedly fall close to the ground. So could have been very nasty indeed. In terms of the type of helicopter involved and the engine involved, is there any concern among other users of the Black Hawk and other users of platforms that use this particular T-700 engine?
Yeah, I mean, I put that to GE. I asked, you know, if they would be issuing a notice or something of that nature to other air forces, or how widespread this problem might be. But they declined to comment specifically on that one. But I suspect, actually, though, if it was a more serious matter concerning other fixed wing rotary aircraft, then yes, GE would have gone ahead and issued a notice. You know, to suggest that the T-700s need to be inspected. But as things stand, that hasn't emerged just yet. So I suppose worth also mentioning some of the aircraft that the T-700 powers. So we're talking about not only the Black Hawk, but the Apache, UH-1Y Huey, Super Cobra, and the NH-90 as well. You know, so that's, you know, when you consider, you know, the length of service that those aircraft have put in over the years, and you know, the numbers that are being flown internationally, then, you know, there's it would be absolutely seismic, I would have thought, if there was an issue with the engine.
Does it appear to be a more of a local issue specific to the Israelis at the moment?
Yeah, exactly. That it appears to be much more of a local issue to the Israelis. That's it.
Moving from the rotary wing sector to unmanned development, in Japan, there appears to be a change of heart regarding Global Hawk acquisition.
Yeah, we just published a story from freelancer Koji Miyake, and that tells of Japan considering the cancellation for an order of three RQ-4 Block 30 Global Hawks. And that follows the United States Air Force budget request proposal showing that the Block 20 and Block 30 will be retired. And interestingly and significantly, that would leave Japan and South Korea as the only RQ-4 Block 30 operators.
So this is appears to be the same old story of high costs for maintenance being less than ideal for those two operators.
Yeah, that absolutely is the big concern here, I think. And, you know, we know from past experience, it's never a good look for a buyer to be getting involved with an aircraft that only has a handful of other customers. So what also is interesting about this one is that the reputational damage caused by the Iranian shootdown of a US Global Hawk really hasn't helped things. I think that may also be at the forefront of Japan's mind here, because obviously with the difficulties surrounding China and potentially having to face up to formidable Chinese air defense systems, you know, going up against those with a vulnerable and expensive system like the RQ-4, I wouldn't have thought would be a wise use of funds. And perhaps this kind of change of heart, or the suggestion from domestic media at least that the change of heart is at hand, then that could explain things. And also, Koji also mentions that the RQ-4 would be reliant on US ground control stations to process data, and that's going to be at a cost of 10 billion Japanese yen. So again, that doesn't really speak to the wise use of funding either. So
now that might leave Northrop Grumman in a rather tricky situation, especially as regards production. Of the Global Hawk.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what's very interesting on this one, I spoke to Northrop Grumman just for an unmanned ISR feature on the 7th of August. They were contributing to that, but they did actually mention as part of our conversation that the RQ-4 for Japan, they had started production ahead of first deliveries, at the end Q4 2021. So, you know, I think that is very, very interesting, because you could potentially be into a situation here of looking for a new buyer for the RQ4. And given the fact that the US are looking to retire the Block 30s, and also given the fact that the only other buyer would be Korea, you're into a worrying situation here from Northrop potentially, or a tricky spot for them at least, because unlike something, you know, unlike the F-35s from Turkey that are now going to be going to the US Air Force, it doesn't look like the US are in any need of any extras, and certainly because they're retiring them, you know, it would be a very, very odd decision.
I wonder if the excess defence articles mechanism might be employed here.
Yes, that could be one option, of course, as you mentioned. Yeah, that might be a sensible workaround.
Thank you very much, Tim. Very interesting developments in the military aviation sector. Moving on to Flavia now, onto the land sector. Let's talk about rockets, and specifically, the US Marine Corps is wanting to procure a next-generation rocket system. Take it away.
Yeah, as you said, Ben, the Marine Corps Systems Command has released a solicitation to procure a shoulder-fired rocket system. The U.S. Army has published in July a request for a proposal on behalf of the Marine Corps. They intend to acquire the M72 light assault weapon fire for enclosure. It's called M72 Law FFE. And this system is manufactured by NAMO Defense Systems, and the Corps will field the system in 2022. It will be used throughout the Marine Corps, but the service at this point couldn't disclose details about the number of systems that they intend to acquire, because they will procure these systems each year, and it will be based on available funding. So at this point, they couldn't provide information about numbers. Also, the Corps, they intend to combine their orders with other service orders to get the best price possible for them. The Corps, they will procure the system in two configurations. The M72A8, that's an anti-armor system, and the M72A10, that's a multipurpose anti-structure munition.
So it sounds like a very, very extensive procurement, but in terms of the readiness of the US Marine Corps, how will this particular system improve that?
So this FFE technology is an upgraded version of the legacy M72 LAW system.
And that's been around for a very long time.
Yeah. But if we compare the M72 systems with the FFE technology, the FFE has an inline trigger, improved sights, and the ability to fire from the side, an enclosure in a cover position, for example. The FFE, it also uses propulsion systems rather than a rocket motor. It reduces noise, flash, overpressure, and also reduces the possibility, the enemy's ability to identify the firing point of origin as well. Also, this system enables Marines to engage various targets, from structures to personnel, for example. And as the M72 LAW FFE is lightweight and more compact, it will help lighten the load for Marines, and it will allow smaller units to increase the amount of shoulder-fired munitions available during their operations.
Great. Thank you very much indeed, Flavia. Listeners can find out more about the stories discussed in this episode and much more besides by visiting our website, shepherdmedia.com/news. Coming up next, I talk to simulation and training editor Trevor Nash to learn more about current trends and new technologies that could change and possibly improve the way militaries train.
My name is Tom Jesse. I'm the Director of Army Initiatives for Viasat. So what I get excited about is, you know, I just recently retired, so I still have a lot of friends and comrades that are out in the thick of it. And so, and I also have a son who just joined the Army, and he's on his way to becoming an airborne ranger. So I want my fellow soldiers and airmen to have the best technology that they can to do well on the battlefield. And Viasat provides that. And so it keeps me involved with Army aviation. I get to go to the units. And it just helps me find out what it is they need and bring that back to Viasat. And then we develop those technologies to help them out. That to me, that's just very exciting.
I'm pleased to welcome for the first time on the Weekly Defense Podcast, Trevor Nash, Simulation and Training Editor at Shepherd Media, to discuss new and upcoming technological trends in this sector. Hi, Trevor. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Ben. Good to be here.
I thought I'd ask you, firstly, about the push towards network training in various projects that are going around the world, such as JP9711 and DOTC.
Yeah, you're right, Ben. Over the last 18 months or so, there have been three major contracts which have been let in the UK, Australia, and in the US. The most recent one to be let was in the US, and that's the SCARS program for the US Air Force, which I'll come on to in a minute. In Australia, JP9711, and in the UK, the Defence Operational Training Capability Air Core Systems and Services, DCS&S. Those programs all really have the same aim, and that is to enable a networked training environment in which collective training can take place. In the UK, that project has been won by Boeing Defence UK. It's also known as Gladiator as well, which is a lot better than trying to recite the acronym every time you say it. And that's taking place in the UK to, as I say, provide this network environment to bring all the simulators together. In Australia, that program was won by Lockheed Martin Australia in conjunction with Australian company Calitrix. And that is designed, again, to enhance their core simulation capability. And SCARS, recently, the most recent one to be awarded a few months back, that was L3 Harris Technologies, Link Simulation, in combination with CAE. Now, the interesting thing about these programs, they're not particularly new. The concept of network training arose really in the mid-80s with the DARPA project and was known as SIMNET, which was a wide area network connectivity, which sowed the seeds. Today, we have the technology to achieve those aims.
So it's really been a case of the ideas were mature enough to apply. It was just waiting for the right technology to come along.
Yeah, absolutely. As I say, the concept of networking has always been there because it provides a wonderful collective training environment. The issue has been, really, that if you don't have the same standards and protocols, it makes it very difficult for one simulator to speak to another. And the three programs that we were talking about earlier in Australia, UK, and the USA, those programs really are laying the groundwork down to enable that collective training to take place.
So in terms of how these different programs are evolving, I mean, is it possible to say that there's a front runner at the moment among those three?
Not really. I mean, they are all operating to achieve the same effect. And in terms of, you know, the UK Gladiator program was awarded first, followed by Australia, and then followed by SCARS, very close together. As one would expect, the country with the most simulators by a country mile is the US. So theirs is definitely going to be the biggest program through the various phases. And it's all comes down to, as I say now, establishing standards and protocols to link the devices together. But it's not quite as simple as that. There are some issues. For example, if I build a simulator today, it has all the modern technology. It has an update rate for the visual system of 120 hertz, high fidelity displays. Now, if I've got to link that to an older simulator that's maybe been in service for 20 or 25 years, the standards, protocols are different, and there are also differences in fidelity of those two devices. So that there are issues.
Are there any workarounds for these problems?
There are workarounds. And it all, as we say, relies upon a couple of software codes to be changed, in theory. It can be done, but you have this fear all the time that if I'm flying the latest F-35 simulator and I'm fighting against a very much older F-16 simulator, we refer to it as a fair fight. In other words, my visual system can see out 30 miles and see the target because I've got the latest in visual and display technology. My adversary in the F-16 has got an older simulator, older visual system, and he can't see me maybe until he gets to within 15 miles.
So I get the impression that all of this requires a lot more investment in terms of time and money to make sure that the technological base is effective enough.
That investment is going ahead now with those three projects. It will take time. And of course, that is providing collective training. The aim is then to link that virtual collective network with more constructive simulation, which is relatively easy because virtual and constructive are digital capabilities, relatively easy to link together. The difficult bit is when you want to start adding live assets into that mix. That's where the issues arise.
The L of LVC. So that kind of level of integration is very much an issue. And I understand it, Trevor, not every requirement is going to need a kind of a high level of integration. And not every training provider can deliver that kind of fully integrated LVC solution on their own. So is this a circle that can be squared?
I think it's a case of horses for courses. If you look at training, military training, it normally takes place for the individual, the crew, and then collectively for the unit. And so individual training, very much so, can be done on a desktop, relatively unsophisticated simulators. When you look at team training, that can again be done in a standalone manner, but perhaps that simulator will have a dual use. So therefore, if it can be used for a team, once that's finished, it can be then connected to the network. That is relatively simple. But you see, the interesting thing, Ben, is if you look at these big contracts that have been let now, the awards have been to big companies, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, L3 technologies. You do see medium-range companies there, SMEs, such as CAE, great experts in this field, Calitrix, exactly the same, are brought in to help. But basically, it's the company with the big bucks, which is less of a risk for the various Ministry of Defences around the world, that will shoulder, you know, the risk factor, as it were.
But as you say, there are still market opportunities for new entrants or startup companies that are very much in touch with the emerging technological trends.
Definitely, definitely.
But without a kind of a real network capability and framework to manage that network in terms of integrated LVC, and despite what you're saying about the integration of small companies and tier one contractors, do you still see a kind of a fragmentation of effort and only a kind of a partial level of solution to complex training and simulation problems?
No, not really. There is always going to be a place for the smaller contractor that has an area of expertise. We can see that at the moment at the Defence Advanced Research Projects Agency. They're working on an AI trial, alpha dogfight trials as they're known, and they're using a lot of very small companies, a lot of very small university faculties that are helping them integrate AI into the concept of future training. So it's that area of expertise, maybe the company that's 5, 6, 7 strong, but have got a real grasp of cutting-edge technologies. And the SMEs and the bigger companies are quite happy then to team with those companies and use that technology in future simulation and future training capabilities.
This Alpha Dogfight series of tests, which are running this week, it's quite fascinating, isn't it? Perhaps you can give the listeners a bit more background about it.
Well, the Defence Advanced Research Projects Agency, their Strategic Technology Office, are managing these trials. And basically what it's looking at is using a virtual simulator and an artificial intelligence environment where the manned virtual simulator flies against an AI target. And the idea of that is to see in future training systems whether we can actually use AI to benefit training. So you don't necessarily have to have another manned simulator. The cost-effective nature of just having an AI entity would be enormous and save potentially over time, you know, millions of dollars in the training area. And again, if you look at that program, it's okay. Lockheed Martin are one of the participants, but mainly it's a lot of very small companies with some very bright people, Silicon Valley, California, using their expertise to, you know, possibly shape the future of training.
It certainly will be interesting to find out the results of these tests, and certainly hope that we can maintain our coverage of that. Just moving in general terms, Trevor, you know, how are Air Forces using AR, VR, mixed reality, the relatively new capabilities of digital twinning? How effectively are our Air Forces using these, would you say?
You could look at it in two ways. One is that it's going to shape the way future training is done. And the other way, because we're still at a very early stage of it, where people are looking at the capabilities that those technologies that you mentioned can help training in the future. I tend to lean to the second approach, the more conservative approach. And I believe that eventually those technologies will have an impact, especially in areas like maintenance training. There are demonstrations already. And for instance, Lockheed Martin at their C-130 training facility in Marietta use an augmented reality environment to enable maintenance technicians to work on a virtual airframe. So it is happening. It is being used. But I think the user community, the air forces around the world, are trying to nail down the real benefits that these technologies can bring before they invest in them.
That's right. You say that the end users are trying to nail down the benefits, but at the same time, so are the people who are planning the doctrine for the Air Forces at a reasonably high level. I suppose there needs to be a certain amount of to and fro between the two sides, the end users and the doctrine planners. To what extent do you see that kind of cross-fertilisation of ideas taking place?
Well, you know, Ben, I think simulation is vital for developing doctrine for new weapon systems, as well as tactics, as we're trying really to make sense of this, you know, so-called fourth industrial revolution people are talking about now. And although not specifically wedded to training, those technologies, modelling and simulation, are ideally suited for concept development, doctrinal development. But as I say, it should not be confused with training. If you look at what's on the table at the moment in terms of future weapon technologies, you know, we've got sixth generation aircraft not too far away, hypersonic weapons, directed energy weapons, you know, the cyber threat continues. It is relatively easy to model those so that we can look at how they will impact future warfare and look at how we can best develop doctrine to counter them. So it's very important.
And certainly the development of AI and the use of AI by militaries is a trend that's been noticed in recent years, and of course it will continue for the foreseeable future. But there are moves to develop ever more autonomous AI systems, even for use on the battlefield, and these have a ever broadening mission set. So in terms of training, Trevor, training with this AI, I mean, is the focus eventually going to be on training the intelligent technology rather than actually training a human being?
That's a great question, Ben. The mealy-mouthed answer would be it's going to be a mixture of both. AI is certainly good. It's getting better. But is it as good as the human, that human in the loop? I know certainly many air forces around the world argue at the moment that it's not as good as the human in the loop because pilots want to fly aeroplanes. That's what they join the air force to do. They don't want unmanned combat aircraft. So that, I think, is swaying the argument a little bit. But in fairness, AI is benefiting from machine learning from some very clever people, such as the DARPA program we were talking about earlier on, enhancing AI in the future. But at the moment, I still think it's a way to go. But taking your premise, I think you're absolutely right to bring it up because we must engage and teach the AI element to improve it all the time, whilst at the same time, if there is a human in the loop in 20, 30 years' time, to also train that human as well.
Thank you very much, Trevor. And clearly, interesting times lie ahead. Listeners may be interested to know that we will be having Trevor back on the podcast at regular intervals to discuss all things bright and beautiful in simulation and training.
Andy Kessler, Vice President and Business Area Director for Viasat's Next Generation Tactical Data Links Business Area. The best part about being at Viasat is the focus where it's all about the best idea. It doesn't matter about seniority. It doesn't matter about politics. What matters is what's the best way to solve the problem at hand. And when you get a bunch of forward-leaning folks from a wide variety of backgrounds together, you get some really interesting ideas and you get some great brainstorming sessions. And the outcome of that can be pretty extraordinary. And that's why you see some of the groundbreaking things that you see us doing, not just in line of sight communications, but in satellite communications and cybersecurity and the like. It all originates from that kind of environment. And that's just a fun place to be. What Viasat is great at is the ability to create that environment where we look at it and say, okay, you know, here is this problem. What can we do to at least mitigate, if not solve, this problem? I think what you have is a scenario where is that almost singular focus about how can we solve these problems? How can we figure out a better way for these jobs to be done? And we do that in a manner where we are generating results that are, I hesitate to use this word, but our customers often refer to as game-changing. And so that's not something that you see a lot of.
The U.S. Army Futures Command was established in 2018 to help drive the force's six modernization priorities: long-range precision fires, next-generation combat vehicles, future vertical lift, the network, air and missile defense, and soldier lethality. These priorities are being driven through cross-functional teams, while AFC oversees the process from its headquarters in Austin, Texas. I'm Jared Cowan, a contributor to Shepherd, and joining me to discuss the modernization priorities is General John Murray, the first commanding general of AFC. General Murray, perhaps starting off, we could talk about the context to the modernization priorities. Is the broad aim to prepare the US Army for a world of increasing peer rivalries, as opposed to the counterinsurgency focus of previous years?
Yeah, you know, the answer in a word is absolutely. We think the modernization priorities, and even bigger than the material priorities, multi-domain operations, the content that we developed, is number one, focused on near peer or peer competition and then conflict. And number two is, you know, what really drove it, and really we kind of predated it, but was when General Mattis came in to be Secretary of Defense and the new and current National Defense Strategy. Clearly focused not only the Army but the Department of Defense on near-peer competition and conflict. We also realized about that time, Jordan, that we had spent at that time, I guess, roughly the last 16, 17 years focused on counterinsurgency, and we were falling further behind. So the difference between near-peer-peer, not a near-peer, from a material standpoint, both China and Russia, which the NDS, clearly the National Defense Strategy, clearly points out, were making significant progress in their modernization efforts. We had been, rightfully so, focused on the fights we were in at the time, and then we had a lot of catching up to do. So that was really the birth of the six modernization priorities, getting not away from a coin fight, because we were still involved in, and we still are in Afghanistan, we are still involved in Iraq, but really reorienting the enterprise, if you will, for the concepts, the organizational structures, and the material we would need to fight and win in a more conventional near-peer fight.
That's great. Thank you. And I think it's been roughly 2 years since AFC was founded to kind of drive the priorities. What are the advantages of focusing on the priorities through a new separate command?
Well, I think, you use the word focus, and that is the ability. So before I came to Austin, Texas, and took command of Army Futures Command, I was the Army G8, so I did all of the programming and really figured out where equipment went. And the one thing that has always amazed me about the Pentagon is you would think strategic level headquarters, we'd be focused 5 or 10 years in the future, and it's about 15 minutes after you walk in that building, you realize you're we call it shooting 50-meter targets. You're dealing with the problems of the day. And it's just hard to find the time to really begin to think into the future, even 4 or 5 years out. We build, as you know, 5-year budgets or 5-year programs, and that's about as far out as we get for the most part. So the ability to focus less on the day-to-day issues of the department and to begin to think about what a possible future could be from an adversary standpoint, to begin to look at technologies beyond what's being worked in programs of record, to begin to think about, how some key technologies could fundamentally change the way we'll organize and fight in the future, and just to have the space to do that. And before, that responsibility fell to an organization called Training and Doctrine Command, and great leaders, great people within Training and Doctrine Command, but they're also responsible for recruiting. They're responsible for all of our professional military education. They're responsible for all the basic and advanced individual training. They're responsible for creating doctrine. And so, that ability to kind of step back and begin to imagine what could be as opposed to what is really the ability that creating a separate command gave me.
And I know it's not been a very long period of time, but in those roughly 2 years, have there been any kind of lessons learned so far that you would highlight really in any area in terms of the way in which you pursue the acquisitions or the CFT concept and so on?
Yeah, I think there's probably more lessons learned and hopefully not forgotten than we have time for. So just a couple key ones. And I think we'll get to this topic, but the power of getting soldiers involved early in a program, well before, you log down a set of requirements for a material solution. And I was just at Fort Carson last week where we're doing an experiment. And it's not an experiment from, traditional scientific standpoint, but going in to look at the impact robotic combat vehicles from a technology standpoint, see where we are in technology, but the impact that will have on how we'll fight in the future is just powerful. And I spent about 3 hours, 3.5 hours on the ground. The last 45 minutes we're talking with a group of about 8 soldiers that had executed this experiment for us. And I told them up front, I don't want to hear anything good about this. Tell me where all the warts are. And they were very brutally honest about where the warts are. And that's all good, because this was about learning. This is about learning about the state of technology from a robotic standpoint. In some early stages of machine learning and artificial intelligence to help with all of it, it was about learning, like I said, where the technology is, but it's just as much about learning how that's fundamentally going to impact. And it's not going to be in the next 2 or 3 years. I mean, this is well into the future, about how organizations will have to change, about the cognitive burden that soldiers can handle in terms of how many robots they can control, about the key technologies we've got to perfect, so we can really begin to invest in our S&T and our DT&E dollars.
That's fantastic. Thank you. And obviously, there are a huge array of acquisition priorities within the six broad priorities. But is there anything in particular coming up over the next year or two that you wanted to highlight? I mean, as I say, I mean, I know there's lots of different things, but was there anything in particular that that you see as a pressing priority?
As you know, 1 through 6, they are numbered for a reason. So there's, you know, long-range precision fire, which is the Army's number one priority. There's a couple key things. I mean, so probably most importantly is a replacement for the what we call the ATACMS missile. So it's PrSM, precision strike missile. Yeah, acquisition. If you just acquisition next couple years, it's obviously what we're going to go into some full rate production decisions on. Would be the way I'd kind of categorize it. So long range fires is probably PrSM, which is going to dramatically increase the range that we're able to, in terms of a missile based system. Extended range cannon artillery, or IRCA, ERCA, is basically doubling the range of our cannon artillery in terms of our mechanized formations. There's lots of key technology to go along with that in terms of the propellant, the type of round, et cetera. So that's those two, and long range precision fires are probably most important. In terms of air missile defense, we're in the middle of a limited user test for integrated battle command system right now. That gives us the ability to tie multiple sensors to an air defense shooter. And so right now, if you look at air defense systems, it's usually individual radars for each system. This will give us the network ability to bring in multiple sensors, which will dramatically, it will increase our capability, and it will dramatically change the way we fight. We're also in the middle of what we call new equipment training for what we call intermediate mobile short-range air defense, IM SHORAD. The Striker-based chassis with a multiple number of effectors on that chassis. And that's really getting short-range air defense back into our formations, which we went away from during the counterinsurgency fight. That's coming up the next couple years. If you look at the soldier lethality piece of it, I mentioned enhanced night vision goggles, binocular, which we have already fielded to a brigade that's in Korea right now. And we'll get into a program of record for that. Next generation squad weapons, so significant improvement in the individual soldier weapon. And then you look at things like the network. So we'll field Cape Set 21 in fiscal year 21, so next year. And it's, you know, we've invested literally billions of dollars in the network we have, so it's just not something you can walk away from. So it's all about how you use commercial technology to enhance and make what you have better. And I'm encouraged because we're not saying this is the way the network's going to look for the next 15 years. We're saying this is what we're going to field in 21, and then 23 we'll come in and touch it again. 25 we'll touch it again. 27, so it's really 2-year increments so we can keep up with the technological changes. We're looking at how we take advantage of 5G when 5G becomes available.
Are there any kind of broad technological trends that you would highlight that perhaps, you know, cross over some of the priorities? So, for instance, something like automation or artificial intelligence, they seem to kind of touch upon a number of different areas. So are there any trends that that kind of cross over different priorities that that you would point to?
Yeah, one of the things that we've been chartered to do, and I'll give you a little bit of background. So there were four things that Secretary Esper, we signed up, we call it the U.S. Army General Order. So this was almost 2 years ago. This coming September will be 2 years. The General Order that established Army Futures Command. And we're doing more than these four, but the four original things were understand what a future operational environment could look like. And you'll never be right when you look into the future and try to figure out what it could like. But look at things like urbanization, demographics, you know, economic factors, climate factors, you know, where the U.S. Army, along with our joint partners and our coalition partners, could be fighting in the future, and begin to describe, not define, but describe that environment. That was number one. Number two was, once you are able to describe that, come up with a concept of how the United States Army, as part of the joint force and with coalition partners, could fight in that environment. Number three was, you know, once you understand or can describe the first two, begin to look at how the Army needs to organize to execute that concept in that environment. And last and least, but not least, is the material solutions, you know, to address those first three. It's great if you can do in that order, but they all kind of happen at the same time. And we talk about various time frames. 2028, you know, sounds like a long ways away, but 8 years is not very far out when you're talking about trying to figure that out. And then we talk about 2035, and the years aren't necessarily important. But as I look at, to answer your question, as I look at the difference between where we are today and probably where we're going to be in 2028, if you talk of things at scale, and where we're going to be in the 2035-ish type time frame, it's really three key technologies. It's artificial intelligence, it's robotics, and it's autonomy. But those three things have to be underpinned by a reliable and robust network and by some sort of data architecture or cloud strategy that enables computing at the edge. So those three technologies, but those two underpinning technologies are absolutely key. People would mention quantum. I don't think quantum will be here in scale on a future battlefield by 2035. But those three absolutely will. And I don't know how much of a historian you are, but it's not dissimilar from where we were at the beginning of World War II. So everybody had tanks, everybody had airplanes, everybody had radios. But how those were applied and the combination of those three really gave the Germans a distinct advantage to begin World War II. And so I think those three technologies, and it's not any one of them, it's how they're applied together, underpinned by those two enabling technologies, who I think are really the fundamental things that we're investing in and really taking a hard look at. And there's others out there that will have an impact. Additive manufacturing will absolutely have an impact. You know, further out, synthetic biology will absolutely have an impact. But those are kind of the three that I'm focused on.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me again, General Murray. Really appreciate it.
This episode of the Weekly Defence Podcast was brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Viasat. As always, a very big thank you to everybody who took the time to participate in this week's episode. And for our listeners, if you enjoyed today's show, please make sure that you like and subscribe or leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also start a conversation or give us feedback by joining the Global Defence Community Group on LinkedIn. This is a platform to interact with our team of journalists and analysts, and you can also discuss breaking news as it happens. Head on over to shepherdmedia.com/globaldefencecommunity or search Global Defence Community on LinkedIn to join. Until next week, thank you for listening.